And now comes the time that we have all been waiting for. I did not have the pleasure to meet our speaker until last night, but in this short time I've come to know Dick, and I actually have become real comfortable around him. And I was worried about that because he's a celebrity. And I didn't know what my inner feelings were going to be. But I see in the short time I've known him that he's just one of us. Amen. He does have quite a background in the show business field. He has a number of movies that are current. Hellraiser, The Filmmakers, Help Stamp Out Fair Play, Get and the Nebraskan. Also a few television stories, Daniel Boone, The Wild Blue, Gunsmoke, Lassie, Legends, and John Parker. I guess that I remember Dick from the Border Patrol that he was in so long, and also Captain Midnight. He's written 3 books, been on the stage, and has produced several plays. So from that standpoint, he's got quite a reputation. When I was in Texas recently, I tried to dig up a little other kind of information on him from an old-timer over there named Bob White. And Bob wouldn't tell me very much, but he did tell me one time he asked Dick why he drank so much liquor. And Bob said Dick's answer was, "Well, what else can you do with it?" But I'm going to let Dick W. tell his own story.
Dick, here.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dick Webb. I'm an alcoholic. I'm appearing here this evening through the courtesy of Smirnoff Vodka, who were my sponsors to get into the program. I like the way that Jim said, up to this point. You know, we have had a great time. And I remember what Franklin said last night about he forgot to go before he got up here. I did too. So I'm going now. You think I'm kidding? You know, the program says where two or more are gathered. It doesn't say anything about 200 or more. I think the last count that I saw on the board out there was 946. Was that upped? That'll make you go. You wonder what in the world, after a track record like I've had in destroying my own career, destroying everything that I loved around me, how in the world anybody could ask people like us to get up and tell our story, or that anybody would even want to listen. But I have come to find in this program the greatest ease and, for me, frantic serenity, as my sponsor tells me that I have. Now, the gentleman over here, this looks like a TV studio with all that bank of everything going on. And he said, one mic doesn't work, and the other one goes over here, and this one goes to the back, and the other one is, you know, I haven't got enough problems. He tells me this, so he said, if you sound peculiar to yourself, and I said, I won't sound peculiar. He'll just ride gain on me. The people whom I've heard speak have just been fabulous. And it always makes me feel inadequate. Of course, I felt like that all my life. That isn't anything new. But to hear all these people speak, and then to think, you have to follow this, you have to follow this, that puts quite a burden. Because as far as I'm concerned, everything has been said before I get up here. And my sponsor, who likes to keep my ego in a proper perspective, when he heard I was coming down here, he said, what are you going for? And I know the right answers now. I didn't a few years ago for him. So I said, because I like to travel. He said, who are you going to help when you get there? I said, me. He said, okay. He said, I guess you're still all right. Because he likes to watch my ego. He's the man, when I had 30 days in the program, he said, you probably won't make this program. And I said, well, why not? He said, your ego is too big. He said, people in show business, he said, we don't have a very good track record. And I've never forgotten that. People in any kind of business don't have a very good track record. I like to identify with as many other human beings as I can, because before I came here, I didn't identify too well with anyone, with myself. About 8 years ago, I came down to Fort Gordon for 2 weeks active duty, going to the Civil Affairs School. I was 14 days, and after 10 days, sitting in those barracks out there every night, I finally hitchhiked a ride into town in uniform, and I found out that there was an AA meeting being held. I think it was the Hill Group, wasn't it? So I wandered in. They were having a potluck dinner that night, and I tell you, I never was so comfortable in all of my life as to get into that meeting. And these people reminded me tonight that it was just about 8 years. I know I was very nervous because one of the fellows had finally talked me into going down to the club. And I had stayed away from the club on purpose. I had no doggone reason for being in there where they were boozing. So I went with him, and it was happy hour when I got there. If you know what happy hour is in the Army, there was a tremendous cacophony of sound. They had a convex bar that you could lie on. You didn't have to stand up. And they were shoulder to shoulder and pouring it down as fast as they could. So over in the corner was a major sitting there with his blouse open. He was out and drooling. So I said, what's the matter with him? They said, he is the happiest man in the place. He is the first one to go out. They pressed me to have a drink. And I said, no. Finally, I just said, no, I'm an alcoholic. They said, shh. I said, what's the matter? They said, the commanding general will not allow alcoholics on the post. He'll throw you right off. I said, well, what's with that major? He said, he's not an alcoholic. He's just happy. They told me that my brain would clear up after I came to AA. And I sure hoped that it would. Because I walked into our clubhouse, into our big meeting room, and I sat down, and there was a sign, you know, the Serenity Prayer was up on a big sign on the wall. And I read it, and I thought, that's beautiful. And I tried to learn it. And I sat there for an hour and a half, and I couldn't remember. I'd learn a line, and I'd close my eyes, and I couldn't remember it. So I sat there, and I cried. My mind was gone. And they told me that these things would pass, and they did. Ultimately, but the way that I got here, and of course, when we talk, we're supposed to talk about what we were like, what happened, and what we hope we are like now. But changes will come about in our lives. So the only thing I can do is to share my experience, strength, and hope with you to the best of my ability. As my sponsor has told me, don't try to be funny, Mr. Webb, because you're not. Just tell your story. It is sick and it is hysterical. So, that is what I will have to do, because there are a lot of people in this room who have heard me speak before. Doggone it. I can't tell too many lies. And my southeastern sponsor, Jim H. back there, has got his eagle eye on me. And he said that he was going to make a lot of noise if I started lying. And he'll do it. So I have to tell the truth. I've made a lot of friends, new friends down here. I've re-met a lot of the people that I met up in Mont Eagle, in Huntsville, and when I was down here on active duty before I got thrown out for being overage. You know, you get old, and you never think it's going to happen to you. But I am actually... I'm not anticipating it, but I'm rather enjoying getting to where I'm getting. I think most of us are like that, if we'll stop to think about it. Because the way that I was, well, there was no future in it. Not a bit. I have always been separated from myself and from other human beings. People were sort of indistinct shadows to me. They were just something to get in my way for the first 45 years of my life. Now, that's a long time to live in this manner. I was scared to death all my life. I always felt inadequate, always felt inferior. Many times I have to fight that feeling now, and people have asked me, well, how in the world did you ever get into show business if you felt that way? And my only answer to it was that I got into show business because I didn't think that I had to be a brain in order to do it. All you have to do is learn a few lines and get up and say them from a stage or in front of a camera, because in every other department I felt inadequate. And it's interesting, I've met a lot of actors. We've sat down and talked about these particular things, and by golly, without even drinking, they feel that way. They have felt inadequate, and they felt inferior. I don't think that God meant us to live this way. So when I came to the program, I was pretty well out of steam. And the things that got me out of steam, and a number of the people here, George and Nick and Jim and various ones, have asked me to tell a few of those things that happened to me that I thought were very normal things when I was drinking. My drinking didn't escalate to any point until about 5 years before I hit bottom, ultimately. During that 5 years, I pulled a few capers, and I have clippings to prove it. Because it seems that I never did anything quietly. I have a tree out in my front yard, a walnut tree, and I was drinking my vodka out of those big, you know, gallon decanters. You put them in a cradle, put a nozzle on them, and I'd put it up high so I'd go by, hit it quick. Warm vodka works better, etc. And I'd wait for my wife to make some kind of a comment, and she ultimately did. So I would take another belt, shoot out the side door and around the drive up into that walnut tree where I had a bottle hidden. I told a psychiatrist about this, and she said, well, what did you think about up there, Mr. Webb? And I said, well, what does any 44-and-a-half-year-old ape think about up in a tree with a bottle? See, I knew what she meant. What did I think about up there? Nobody knew where I was. And then she asked me the $64 question. She said, well, whom did you think cared? Now, we have been told and we know that we are very sensitive people. We don't like that kind of dialogue. I thought that everybody wanted to know where I was. I thought that I was the cynosure of all eyes, and I was. They were hoping that I'd go away somehow. Simple, normal little things to me, like getting all alone, drinking up in a tree. I heard about a gal one night that drank in a cave out behind her house. And another little gal, you know, if you, some of you people who are new here, you hang around long enough, you're going to hear your story. There was another little gal that used to get drunk and load a 38, go in the bathroom, turn off the light, pull the trigger, and then duck. I said, what'd you duck for? She said, I'd like to hear it go, chung, 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 down the road. I identified with that little girl. She only weighed about 100 pounds, soaking wet. I never thought I'd identify with a gal, with her stories. But the longer you're in the program, the more you identify with people. So finally, you begin to find out that you really are a human being. We're part and parcel of all of our brothers and sisters, and now we're coming to find out that we're even part of the plants and the insects and the birds and things. They hooked up a polygraph to a plant. I just read this the other day. The guy was sitting there fooling around with this polygraph on a plant. It was in Fate magazine a few weeks ago. and he thought, he had some other plants in the room, and he thought, well, I'm going to pull those other plants up and throw them out. And the needle began to fluctuate. He began to try other experiments. He got some other researchers in, and they even boiled a pot of water in the room, and they brought in some live shrimp. They were going to pour them in this thing, and the needle began. Now we know that even the plants feel things. Whether they think or not, I don't know. I'm going to have to go sit out in a field sometime of waving grain and think I'm going to cut you down and see if I get a move from it. But I'm beginning to identify with all the rest of life, is what I'm trying to get at. I never did this before. I did my stint as far as hunting and shooting things senselessly and destroying things. First of all, I was destroying myself. When I drank, I went insane. We have heard many people say this, and I'm convinced that it's true. I'd have my wife in the car with me various times, and I had a .357 Magnum revolver that I always carried because it was a little larger than a .38. And I'd drive up our main drag out in San Fernando Valley, Ventura Boulevard, 90 to 100 miles an hour, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, straddling the white line, that Magnum in my hand, waiting for somebody to stop me. My wife would be cowering down in the well of the front seat. You know, I'd run all the stop signs, and there wasn't a soul going back and forth. About 10 miles, you know the way we are, we finally give it up. So I'd hand her the gun, she'd unload it and put it away. I'd turn around and come back. Stop at the stop signs, people are walking back and forth, police cars are cruising up and down. I never got caught. I never once got caught except by myself. And I had an agent who was visiting me one night in my home, and I was sitting up at the head of the room in my favorite shooting chair with my .357 Magnum revolver just hanging at the hip. We were talking. I was pretty oiled, and he was about half-bagged. And I just pulled this Magnum up from the hip, and I was, boom! I pulled off a shot at him. It missed him about 3 inches. I still have the hole in the sash in the window. He looked at me, and he says, "It cracks when it goes by." This is the man who sent me my copy of the Big Book. He didn't bring it out to the house. He sent it. He had given that same copy to an alcoholic actor in New York many years before that. And the actor stayed with the program for a while, and he ultimately flipped and he died. So when I shot at this guy, he sent me the book. It's one of the older copies, I understand. It has the yellow and the red cover on it. And that book has become quite dog-eared. And I've made notes all through it. I go back and refer to it. Because my sponsor is a book man. And he queries me on the book all the time. He will quote things from the book that maybe I am not familiar with, and say, "Where did that come from, Mr. Webb?" In the Bible. And then I'll have to go back. He makes me read the Big Book at least once a month, or a portion thereof. You know, I don't know of anyone who has started out to be an alcoholic. If there's anyone present in the room tonight who did, I would like to talk to them later, because that'd make quite a story. Just sat down and started out, said, "I'm going to be an alcoholic," and started drinking the way that we drink. I was interested to find out that it takes you females much less time to become an alcoholic than it does the guys. If you really apply yourself to it, really work at it, you can do it in 2 years after you start. So if any of you are wondering, you gals, if you're wondering if you're really an alcoholic, why, check and see how long you've been drinking, and maybe you have 6 or 7 months to go. If you want to hurt that much, and continue to do it. I have about 15 or 16 bullet holes in my house because during the time that I was doing the Captain Midnight and the Border Patrol series, I collected guns, and I had 56. Now, this is always recommended for a practicing alcoholic, to collect guns. Interesting, too, that every time I bought a gun, I'd go on a television show, and I'd have the moderator or whomever ask me what my hobby was, and then I'd turn into the camera and say, I collect guns. And if any of you people out there have guns that you'd like to sell, why, you let me know. You call me. I'd get a whole flock of numbers and grab a bottle and a taxi cab, and I'd start going around. I'd buy a gun, and I'd turn away from the people that were there, and I'd look at the gun, and I'd say, maybe you're the one who wanted to do what? Well, sooner or later, I was going to shoot myself. And I knew it, because you couldn't live the way that I was living and not finally get to this place. So I wound up with 56 guns. I'd stopped going out to the desert, which is a great love of mine, and up to the High Sierras. And you have to exercise those guns someplace, so I shot them in the house. I'd shoot through the back window from my favorite shooting chair. You know, there are people out there. People lived out. That fast draw on the window panes. There are bullet holes in the block walls on both sides of my house. A new family moved in about 4 or 5 years ago next door, and I went over to say hello to this new guy, and we were walking around the backyard, and he has a palm tree out there, and there was a big hole in this palm tree. And without even thinking, I said, wonder what caused that. He looked at me, he says, you did. I said, I did? He said, yeah. He said, people that I bought this house from, they said that you were nuts. And that you shot holes in the block wall. I did all these simple, normal little things. People wish that I would go away. The interesting part, too, about it is that the majority of we alcoholics, when we're sober, we're pretty nice people. We don't bear any resemblance to that idiot that I qualified to be when I was drinking. So my wife used to make notes on me about what a nice guy I was when I was sober, so that when they came to take me away, she could give them these notes and try to help me a little bit, you know, so they wouldn't put me in the fidget farm and keep me there or into prison for the rest of my life. But I sure was trying. I was doing a series called U.S. Border Patrol. I wore a Smokey Bear hat and chased aliens. We came down through Augusta. I've been in Augusta a couple of times on those personal appearance tours with the Captain Midnight series and with the Border Patrol series. I don't remember too much about being in Augusta. I don't remember where I was. It was kind of like maybe those peace officers feel who busted up the six rooms here. They probably don't remember even being here. Well, I didn't. You know, people have asked me if actors get carried away with the role that they're playing. They identify so closely that they take on the character of the individual. I think it was you and your wife that asked me that. And I said, why, no. But I played a Border Patrol chief. And I got on a plane one day to go down to Miami to make the last four shows of that Border Patrol series, and I started drinking on the plane. I drank what the stewardess would give me until, of course, they got over the state of Texas, and then they don't give you anything. So I drank my own. I got off in New Orleans, and I bought another bottle. My tolerance was quite high during those days. I would do two-fifths before I could really get up to speed. Got off in New Orleans, bought a bottle, got back on the plane, opened it, and started nipping on that. And when I was drinking, I was very gregarious. So I got two guys across the aisle engaged in conversation with me, like, where do you come from? The guy said, I'm Germany. I said, oh, I said, well, you come from Germany. I said, you're an American citizen? He said, oh, yeah. I said, then you have to have a passport. He said, no, I don't have a passport. Well, any Border Patrol chief knows you got to have a passport. So I asked the guy with him, I said, where do you come from, sir? He said, around. Now, I knew there was something wrong with him. So I continued to question these guys. And then I got out a notebook and began to make notes on their answers. And when I felt that I had them pretty well sewed up, I called the stewardess and I said, I'd like to speak to the captain, please. And she said, well, who are you? What do you want? What's it about? Now, I didn't tell her that I was a chief. And I pulled my attaché case out from under the seat, and it has one of those big blue and gold Border Patrol, Bureau of Immigration and Naturalization, very impressive thing, you know. And she said, oh, well, you know, and up to the pilot's cabin I go. I read my notes, told my story. I conned the pilot, the co-pilot, the radio operator, and the engineer. You know, if my wife had been along that night, this probably wouldn't have happened, because when I had that much flit in me, my left eye rolled over in the corner, and that's where it were. She knew that I wasn't even on the plane, but she wasn't there. So the captain said, what do you want me to do, Mr. Webb? I took over the plane. Pilot doesn't ask a passenger what he wants him to do in situations like this, but, you know, I wish I was half as smart, sober as I was brilliant when I was drinking. I've been pretty dull since I've been a member of AA. So I told him, I said, when you get close enough to Miami, you call your office to call the Border Patrol to tell the chief to meet me at the bottom of the ramp. I got a couple of live ones back here. And he said, I'll do it. And he did. Naturally, I was the first one down the ramp. They had ramps in those days. And there were a line of guys here. There was a truck with a searchlight on it. It was going back and forth, and I wondered who was coming in, and it was me. Because the Border Patrol series was on down there in Miami, and the way that the captain had transmitted the message was that a Border Patrol chief has two spies on Flight 704. So I turned around, and as these two gentlemen alighted, I took them by the cuffs of their coats, and I said, gentlemen, you will remain here until the proper authorities arrive. This is a citizen's arrest. With that, the proper authorities who were already there arrived. They marched us across Miami Airport. Photographers and reporters were all there. You know, that was, Khrushchev was over here at the time. And that was before all these things, you know, to Cuba and around here and there. Maybe I had the hand in it. I don't know. Get all this started. So they took us down into an interrogation room. Put these two guys in up on a table and me in a nice comfortable chair. And I sat there and I told my story. I read my notes and these guys were sitting up there shaking. There were six police listening to this testimony that I was giving. And I got all through and I reached under and pulled out my attaché case, opened it up, pulled out my bottle and... It had been a long story and I was thirsty. Well, I guess the sergeant conducting the interrogation saw the eye, and he must have known what that meant. He'd probably seen a lot of eyes like that. So he looked at the two guys, and he said, you gentlemen may go. When he looked at me, he said, you better go too. But it was a little late. These guys didn't like what I had done. They were a couple of insurance salesmen, one from Seattle and one from Salt Lake City. But they both had on black coats and they wore black hats. And you know they had to be heavies. 4 days later, we were out in the Everglades shooting some scenes for one of the shows, and a very personable young man approached me and he said, are you Richard Webb? And I said, yes. He said, here. There were subpoenas. $250,000 against National Airlines, $250,000 against my ex-boss, $250,000 against me, and $47,000 punitive damage. You add it up, that's what, $797,000. What was my reaction to this? It was a case of mistaken identity. It could have happened to anybody. But it didn't. It happened to me. Why? Because I was a practicing alcoholic. I was nutty as a fruitcake when I drank, and I was getting to the place where I was nutty when I was sober. Well, there was quite a stir, caused by all this. I'm one of the very few civilians who has ever had a special order issued by the Border Patrol chief in Washington to the effect that I was persona non grata to the entire Border Patrol. 4 years later, which was 3 years after I came into the program, and just I had come down to Fort Gordon, and the people here tell me that I was talking about going to Miami to get tried for this thing. And they told me at the time, they said, when you appear for trial, tell the truth. That's difficult, to tell the truth. I'd been living all those years in unreality. Never, never land. Now I'm to go tell the truth. Finally, the call came for me to go down to Miami. And I called my sponsor and I said, they're only after money. He said, yeah, that's right. How much was it? I said, $797,000. I said, I ain't going. He said, Mr. Webb, our program suggests that you clear up the wreckage of your past. And I said, yeah, well, that's fine, but I ain't going. Because I could see myself breaking coral down in St. Augustine with a striped suit on. I went on National Airlines very quietly. They came by with the booze. Of course, it brought back the flood of memories. I got off, and they had pulled that case out of the files again, and they had made a big to-do about it. So when I got to my aunt's house where I was staying during my duress, I looked in the phone book, and I got the number of an AA clubhouse. It was the Friendship Club. Many of you here have probably been down there. I called them, and they were about 8 blocks from me. I didn't wait to borrow a card or rent one or anything. I trotted over to the Friendship Club. I burst in, and I said, my name is Dick Webb. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from California, and I'm going to get tried, and I need help. And I wasn't kidding, and they knew it. So when the trial started, all out through the courtroom spectators were members of the Friendship Club. Little smile, little wink, then when the judge would call recess, there they were around me. I couldn't go to the men's room alone. Nothing. I'd ask for help, and they were going to see that I got it. So the trial was, I don't know, about 4 days long. We had a jury. For the first time in my life, I sat in public, and I told the truth. I grant you, every once in a while, I'd look up and say, God, do you know what's going on down here? Are you really paying any attention to what this is? I admitted that I lied in my deposition. I lied in my statement. They had all the clippings of other things that I had done, so the opposing attorney would show them to me. And he says, what does this mean, Mr. Webb? I said, well, I got in trouble doing so-and-so. I did this, did that, the other. Why did you do it? I says, because I'm an alcoholic. And I talked about these things. The judge was sitting up there at the bench, and every once in a while he'd look at me. And I thought, he is prejudicing the jury when he does that. Well, the jury was out for 2.5 hours. And I thought, see, here I am trying to clear up the wreckage of the past, and they're going to hang me. I just knew it. They came back in. I found out later that the World Series was going on, too. They already decided what they were going to do with me, but they were watching the World Series. Everybody got off of the general charge of $250,000, and I was guilty on the punitive damage charge. And immediately I said to myself, see there, that's what you get for telling the truth. Each one of the plaintiffs collected $1 apiece, so they could never sue me again, because I told the truth up on the stand, and these guys lied. They just lied up a storm. After it was all over, I went over to thank the jury, the members of the jury. I came to one fellow, and I said, Mr. Jordan, when you were being impaneled, they asked you if you'd ever had any court actions against you, and you said, yes, automobile accident, but you hadn't had a drink in 3 years. And I said, just the way you said it, I said, are you a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? He looked at me with a big smile. He said, why, sure, anyone who is anyone is in AA today. I decided, well, the judge called me back into his chambers and he said, "Mr. Webb, you members of Alcoholics Anonymous are fantastic. You're wonderful. It's beautiful when you're working your program." He said, "You're the fourth member of AA that I've had before my bench as a defendant." And he said, "Usually most of you are defendants." But he said, "Whatever you're doing, you keep on doing it." And right then, ladies and gentlemen, I decided that I would never again question the book, the program, the people, or anything about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't for about 3 weeks. You know, there's enough power in this room. If all we alcoholics went out and got drunk all tonight at the same time to set off the atomic bomb without the use of any hydrogen, we were a gas. And sober, we are pretty terrific people. I imagine many of you are aware of the fact that perhaps we may have a presidential candidate who is one of us. A pretty terrific guy. I think now he has maybe 19 or 20 or 21 years in the program. He is a senator from a certain state, and he's a pretty terrific character. They went after him in his own state of Iowa when he was running for governor. And he flew back to New York and had a large meeting with the General Service Board. Told him what he wanted to do. He wanted to go public because he knew the opposition was going after him. So they said, "Okay, you go ahead." He went back, and when they attacked him, he went on radio and television. He said, "Yes, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't had a drink in 11 years. Anyhow, he won the governorship of Iowa with the greatest landslide known in the history of that state. And then when the senator thing came up, he got that. There's nothing wrong with our intellect, I have found out, and I like to keep saying this to remind myself. The average alcoholic is above average mentality, regardless of our educational level, whatever. We're pretty sharp people. My wife went to Al-Anon 8 months before I came into the program. And I want to say a few words about that Al-Anon. I didn't know what was happening to her, but she didn't seem to be paying as much attention to me. And it seemed that I had to go to greater lengths and greater heights to get a reaction out of her, which, of course, I did. And I used to kid her, and I used to get vicious. "What do you broads do? You get in there and you talk about your drunken husbands and all this stuff, you know. The same old dialogue that all of us have used about the Al-Anon people." And I followed her out to the car one night, and I was going on this tack, and she turned around very calmly. She said, "Okay, I won't go anymore." And something clicked. I looked at her for a moment, and I turned around and gave her a little slap on the fanny. And I said, "You go on, sweetheart." I said, "Maybe it's good for you." Something happened. Something was getting through to me. I have found in my own experience that, my own experience and my own reading, that this is a family problem. We're all involved with it. And I have found that my wife is as sick as I was. And my wife will be the first one to tell you that she is still as sick as I am. She's been a member of Al-Anon for these years. They told her that when she came to her first Al-Anon meeting, she was the most furious woman they had ever met. 10 angry women. She's gone to her meetings and I've gone to mine. You know, over a period of time, we have both progressed at about the same rate. In fact, I think she's a little ahead of me, like 8 months. But the thing works, and it makes me very sad to hear members of Alcoholics Anonymous downgrade and deride Al-Anon. Because this is a twofold disease that we have we alcoholics, but our mates have a like disease that has to be treated. They wouldn't have married us if they hadn't loved us, but they also saw in us, subconsciously perhaps, a lot of the same emotional bags that we had. Opposites attract and like attracts. And I have been guilty myself in the past, in the early days, of making derogatory remarks about Al-Anon. But I guarantee you what I have seen, and I have spoken at a few Al-Anon meetings and the Alateen meetings, I have the greatest respect for it. I'll go out on a limb and say the next time that any of we alcoholics begin to talk against or down about Al-Anon, stop and think for a minute. You still got that mate. They live through these things with us. They're trying to do the best they can. And now that we have become gods in AA, please don't stumble on the waves. You know, there's a... The last days of my drinking were like the last days of Pompeii. I was functioning fine. I never drank on the set. I never drank during the day. I drank on my time off. I drank on weekends. But when I drank, I went insane. I was an emotional bomb. To this day, I cannot tell you truthfully that I was addicted to the use of alcohol. Because I could go a week, 2 weeks, so on. But when I drank, I went nuts. And I would always leave, about a half inch. It was a half pint, a pint, a fifth, a quart, or a gallon, or 2 gallons. No, I'd always leave about a half inch in the bottom of the bottle. And my wife asked me, she said, why do you leave that little bit in the bottom? I said, nobody can ever accuse me of killing the bottle. The way our thinking goes, and I used to carry those little bottles in the car, and when I would finish them down to that much, drive home, and I have ivy in the front yard, open the window, throw those bottles out in the ivy. So 6 or 8 months after I came into the program, my wife went out there and wandered through the ivy and picked up two bushel baskets of bottles, and she was pouring one into the other, and she finally wound up with over a half a pint of vodka. I have been actually fortunate because since I came into the program, not on, I have had no compulsion to take a drink. I've had a compulsion to escape because I've escaped all of my life. And that naughty little thing up here has said from time to time, take a pill. Nobody will ever know. Well, I was in the clubhouse one afternoon out in North Hollywood, and some guy came in on pills, and I said, oh, yes, they will know. We have, I don't know how it is here, but people are people. We have a number of people out on the coast now who don't seem to think that there's anything wrong with taking pills. And I've talked to some of them, and I say, you're on pills, man. You're high on a kite. And they look at you with their eyes all bleary, and they say, well, but I haven't had a drink. This program works better if you don't drink and you don't take pills. Because this is a spiritual program, and we're supposed to have a 180-degree turn in our lives. I have to do away with the mind-benders, the hallucinogenics, you name it. My sponsor has told me, he has 25 years in the program, and if I had to live the program the way that I have observed him living it, I would rather shoot myself. I tell me. But that's good for him. He's told me, Mr. Webb, there is no place to hide. He said, but if you should ever find one, he said, would you call me and tell me I've been looking for it for 25 years? It isn't a question of willpower with me to keep from drinking. I shot my willpower a long time ago. It's just a question of the thing that psychiatry tries to induce in us, and that is the surrender. Surrender. Give up. Don't do those things that we were doing. My sponsor, if I may make passage on it, also says, because he's quite a believer in this particular postulate, Mr. Webb, if you do not do these things now that you are supposed to do, you may have to come back and do them all over again. Now, can you think of any more horrible thing to envision than have to come back and do it all over again? Not in view of my track record. So I'm going to try just one day at a time. That's all they asked me to do, this thing. One day at a time. My last 10 days of drinking were quite calm. I was doing 2/5 a day for those last 10 days. And something's got to give. So at the 10th day, it was on a Sunday morning, and I had always prided myself on never drinking in the morning. Only drink at night and on weekends and so on. Well, I had started drinking early that day. I came busting in the house, kicked off my shoes, pulled over a table, looked at my wife and said, "Now I'm going to kill you." Now, she'd been going to Al-Anon, as I say, for 8 months. Normally, this girl sleeps until 10, 11, or 12 on a Sunday. But this particular Sunday morning, she had gotten up, put on her clothes, and she even had her running shoes on. So when I informed her that I was going to kill her, she took off out the side door. And I proceeded to bust up the house pretty good. And amidst all the shambles, I thought, well, I've got to go now. I'm all through. So I went in, loaded my .357 Magnum revolver, went into my den, sat down with a glass full of booze, cocked the .357 Magnum, stuck it in my mouth. And I sat there meditating. As my sponsor said, "What else are you going to do at a moment like that?" See, I wanted to die. Many of us have. And I was afraid to. I was sitting there with that cocked magnum in my mouth, and nobody was trying to stop me. And I got scared. And I got lonely. They call alcoholism the lonely disease. A lot of us have driven everyone completely away from us. And a lot of them would just assume we'd go ahead and blow our head off. But I thought to myself, "Self, what are you going to do now?" And the little voice said, "Why don't you call your friends to do this job?" My friends being the Van Nuys Police Department. Because they had guns, you know, they'd be able to do these things. So I carefully took the gun out of my mouth. You know, it might get hurt if it went off. Uncocked it, laid it down, called the Van Nuys Police Department, and told the guy, whom I found out later, it was Scotty, what I had in mind. I wanted them to come out for a gun battle in my front yard. Well, doesn't everybody do these things? To me, it made a lot of sense. I could see these two young bucks driving up in a police car. They'd get out. I had my gun on the hip, and we'd all, you know, it'd be all over. So Scotty told me what he thought about the idea. It wasn't very complimentary. And then I fired the Magnum alongside the phone. And there was a little silence as Scotty said later he got up and changed ears. Large Magnum, small room, big noise. And he said, "Where do you live, Mr. Webb?" And I told him. He said, "We will be out shortly." I said, "Thank you very much." Great dignity, great self-respect. I was barefooted, had on a pair of slacks, no shirt, had on a Sam Brown belt, and had that .357 Magnum. I don't know how much later it was, maybe 15, 20 minutes. My mother, who was in a wheelchair, had gone into her room to get out of the line of action. She called in to say, "There are some men in the front yard." And I said, "Thank you very much." I got up, checked the gun, and took off, walked down the hall. And, you know, I could feel the bullets hitting me. They were going to make big holes in me, and the nice clean air and the sunshine were going to go through, and I wouldn't have to hurt anymore. And man, I desired that. So I turned the corner to step outside, and I stopped and I combed my hair in the front room. Well, that was a very important interview. You know, you can't go with your hair all messed up. I stepped outside. Scotty was there. He had heard that Captain Midnight had gotten off Ovaltine. And they all wanted to come down to see what was going on. There were 12 of them out there. They had everything, I found out later, trained on me but a 155. And Scotty had said, if that idiot twitches, cut him in two. They were all loaded. So I stepped out in all of my regality, barefooted, pair of slacks, no shirt, Sam Brown belt, loaded 357 Magnum, and combed hair. And I began to talk to Scotty. Unbeknownst to me, three of the fellas had gone around behind my house and gotten up on the roof, and I have a low overhang roof. So as I was talking to Scotty, they were coming down the back. There were photographers and reporters out there. Stuff. So finally, I looked at Scotty and I said, you draw first. I think I can beat you. If I'd had 14 hands, I couldn't have found that gun, you know. I didn't want to shoot them. I wanted them to shoot me. Well, Scotty kept me talking, and these three police descended from the roof. And they said that I carried all three of these guys on my back with their feet off of the ground. They were trying to down me. I had a little smile on my face, and I walked about 10 feet with these guys hanging on me. Then they tripped me, and down I went. The next thing I remember is lying on the floor of the back seat of the police car, on my stomach, handcuffed, my hands behind me, and two of the police with their feet in my back sitting there smoking cigarettes. And I looked at him and I said, well, fellas, this isn't what I meant. Let's go back and do it again. Our big book talks about the fact that we're the writers, producers, actors. We score it. They had plumb ruined my script. They took me down and they booked me into Van Nuys jail. There was quite a fanfare over the thing, and it was actually in one thing it was written up like that. Captain Midnight gets off Ovaltine. I told him later, I said, yeah, but that Ovaltine is murder on the rocks. They had me for... One of the policemen said that I shot at him. I hadn't even unholstered the gun. And I don't know which meeting he's going to now. Whether it's AA or recovery or what have you. So they had me for about $150,000, $200,000 bail. Or there was no bail. And they put me in an attempt at a felon cell. This was a new jail out in Van Nuys, and, you know, if you like jails, it was a beautiful thing. Outside of playing a scene in a jail cell, I don't particularly dig them. But this had, you know, a nice new thunder mug and a nice new metal bunk and nice new bars and a 2,000-watt bulb in the ceiling. So when I awakened at 4 o'clock in the morning or thereabouts, or came to, I got up and just stood there, stark naked. And I was completely out of steam for the first time in my life. And I had what I call, to me, if not a spiritual, a mystical experience happening. Or happened because, you know, it could have been just a hallucination or whatever. But all of a sudden, I'm standing here and I saw me standing over about 5 feet from me, stark naked. And I thought, Webb, you're getting fat. And one of the bars of that cell seemed to be bigger than the other ones, and it was white hot. And I saw myself go across and put my arms out, and I heard my voice say, God, I'm naked, and I embraced the flame. And I put my arms around that thing, and it didn't burn me, and then the thing faded. I told this at a couple of meetings when I was fairly new in the program. I very seldom tell it. Because people come up to me later, some of them, and they say, wow, you had a spiritual experience, man. You got it made. And then I found the answer to that. But the Catholic priest and the Protestant who were sitting at ringside, the bell rang, and one of the fighters crossed himself, and the Protestant said, Father, does that really help him? And the priest said, only if he can fight, my son, only if he can fight. I got a $150 fine, finally, out of that. All the city police and the city fathers and everything got on my side because two detectives came down. They took me up into an interrogation room, and they said, "What's your problem, Dick?" And, you know, for the first time then, at that moment in my life, I just let everything go. And they said I sat for about 4 hours, and I talked about everything that had ever happened in my life. I let it all out, which I'd never done to a psychiatrist. And they got on my side, and during the day they would come in looking more and more disheveled and throw down a paper and say, "Well, we finally got a $100,000 bail set on this. Oh, we got $50,000, $25,000. They handcuffed me to a radiator. Finally, these two guys came in late in the afternoon, and they threw down the last paper, and they said, "Best we can do is a $150 fine." So I paid the $150 fine, appeared before the judge, and he said, "Don't drink." This had become quite obvious to everybody, because I have clippings from all over the country about little didos that I pulled. Now, you know, people in show business don't particularly dig that. Sponsors don't like it. It makes them nervous about their product. Because here is a character, let's say, selling Ovaltine, which is for kids, and that idiot is drunk, and he's shooting up places, and he's... They don't dig it. Well, I got out late that afternoon from Van Nuys Jail, and for the first time during that 8-month period, I went to a meeting as a member in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been going drunk and drinking, and usually if it was close enough, I'd hide a bottle outside of the meeting. And every once in a while, I'd tell people, you know, I had kidney trouble. Boom, out, bang, oh, back in. Large kidney trouble. I sneaked into a meeting that was being held in a garage, and I poked my head up over the stairwell, and the guy who was leading the meeting looked over and he said, "Hello, Dick." He said, "We were hoping that you'd make it here." And I said, "I got no other place to go." And that started my career in Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me to take it easy, that I would go through various periods, and I did, highs and the lows and up and down and resentments and rage and guilt and self-pity. But they said there's a power greater than yourself, and it's going to help you if you'll depend on it. I have a fellow I'm working with right now, and he called me up and he says, "You know," he says, I don't know what's the matter with me," and he said, "maybe I'm not working the program right," but he said, "I've walked out of 2 meetings in the last week, just got up and walked out." And I said, "Don't let it bother you." I said, "I got up and walked out of 3 meetings in one night." I said, "The important thing is you keep coming back." People who are new here tonight in the last 2 or 3 days, they will be able to hear just so much. I think the big thing that we get when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous is the feeling, the group feeling, that there is hope, that these people are what they say they are. They're alcoholics and they have recovered. I used to listen to people tell stories out at the clubhouse and around the various meetings in California, and I think, he's lying. Gotta be. Many of you know Chuck C. from Laguna B. I was still drinking when I heard Chuck speak, and I got furious because there seemed to be a light around this guy. You know, it was an aura around him. And I was sitting down pretty close, like this gentleman is here. You know, Chuck has that little way. When he looks at you, he looks right through you. He knows what's going on in your head. Of course, I was guilty anyhow. He leaned over after he said something, looked at me. And I thought, he does that once more, I'm going to get up and walk out of here. And he did it once more, and I got up and I walked out. It was on a wooden floor, and I made sure that I stomped all the way. Chuck stopped talking, and I thought to my drunken self, you showed him, and I left. 6 months later, I was in the program, and I listened to Chuck speak. Got a lot more out of it then. And after it was over, I went over to him, and I said, Chuck, I want to apologize for... He says, please, Dick, with that manner he has. He said, I remember. He said, you were beautiful. He said, you were so dramatic about the whole thing. That is how I started in AA. Things that I have found out since I got here are too numerous. They're too actually mystical to ever explain. Nobody can tell you how AA works, beginning with Bill W. Jim H. might. I don't know. I had to do that, Daddy-O. But you learn to be a member of the human race. And we're not that much different. I don't give a damn how different you think we are. I may not be a female. I may not have drunk like a man. I may not have drunk like a female. I don't know the difference. How many times have we been told, drink like a man? Maybe I drank like a woman. I don't know. The only difference is that we're built differently, and I like that. Although I have walked out of 3 meetings in one night, and I have resigned from meetings, and I've criticized people, and I've taken inventories, and I've screamed and hollered and fallen down. My sponsor, when I call him and tell him about these things, he says, keep coming back. Keep coming back. This too shall pass. Most of those things have passed. So when I say that to be invited to appear before a group of people of the size of this one, and particularly at your 17th AA convention here in Savannah, see, I've cleared up since I came to AA. I did a part in one of the segments of the Star Trek series some time ago, and the guy had to be nuts. So it was no problem to play it. He had to start out in the picture pretty high and then go higher. He was angry because he hadn't been promoted over Bill Shatner, who was the lead in the story. Go ape. It was actually a difficult part to do because I didn't know many of the members of the cast at all. It was my first day going in there, and they put a 2x4 on the front of the camera with a boxing glove on it, put it in my stomach, said, follow wherever the camera goes, remember your lines, and do your thing. And when the part was over, the director, whom I'd known for quite a while, came over to me, and he said, Dick, I've known you for 20 years. And he said, I have never seen you do a job like this. He said, what in the world happened to you? And I looked at him, and I smiled, and I said, I have a higher director. Because before I approach any job now, I stop just for a moment and I say, thank you, God, for giving this to me. I wouldn't have gotten it if you didn't think I could do it. I think one of the first things that I regained after I came here was my dignity and my self-respect. 6 months after I came into the program, I returned to Paramount Studio, where I had started out in show business. I walked in on the lot, and people were, they were a little nervous. One guy said, Dick, he said, my God, how can you come in here with all these people knowing what you've done? And I looked at him, and I said, well, but I don't do it anymore. He said, yes, but, my God. I have met many actors that I started out my career with. Two of them are roaring alcoholics. They're dying. I met one who was internationally known a few months ago on Paramount lot. He's all bent, wrinkled, and shriveled. I'm 5 years older than he is. And he said, "Dick, my God," he said, "I know you're older than I am." He said, "What in the world has happened to you? You look great." And I thought, I'll lay it on him. I said, "I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been in it almost 10 years now." He said, "Oh, yeah, that's great. I'll see you around." Take off. I am happy and I'm proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I like to remember that little thing. Anyone who is anyone is in AA today. You look around you. You can go to some of these meetings. If you want to find names and wealth and et cetera, we've got it. The politicians even like to come to our meetings now around election time because we're getting pretty big. It was a question of whether I should reminisce on some of the things that I thought that I heard when I first came to the program. To it, not in it. And I was sure that I heard a guy say when he was reading the fifth chapter, which we do a good deal of, "Rarely have we seen a person go to jail who has thoroughly followed our path." That's true. You know, the Freudian slips that we make when we read these things sometimes. Sought through prayer and medication to improve our conscious contact with God. And there was a little gal got up. I don't know whether she'd been playing around with those lines or not, she and some of her friends. But she stood there and read the chapter one night, and she says, "Half-assed measures availed us nothing." You know, the reason we laugh the way we do, because we know that's true. Either you got to do it or you don't do it. But you don't do it half. Like a friend of mine told me, he says, there's no such thing as being half pregnant. Either you is or you ain't. And that's good enough for me. I know the thing has worked, because I've seen it work. I've seen the changes in my own life, and a thing like tonight is truly remarkable to me, to be asked to come down to address a group like this. I believe in my own opinion, of course it's true, that this is purely and simply a spiritual program, not a religious program. If it was a religious program, I don't think I'd do too well. But there's a large concept of a power greater than ourselves, which we call God. And as Franklin said last night, I make no excuses for my belief in God, a power greater than myself. So I'd say that this is your 17th convention, give it another 10 years, and if you would, invite me back again, see if I've made any progress at all. And I might, one day at a time. I want to thank each and every one of you for having me down here. I've had a wonderful time, and I expect to talk to a lot of people after the meeting and tomorrow before I take off. We'll always be together in the Spirit because we're trying to do the same thing under the same concept. And it's really beautiful. And for you members of Alateen, God bless you. That little girl this morning was just fantastic. Everyone who has spoken up here has been fabulous. And as Jim said before I spoke, up to this point. For those of you who remember, this is Captain Midnight signing off with the code of the Secret Squadron. Justice through strength and courage. Out.